This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we catch up with Naples resident and bird enthusiast Evie Morrell, who has spent the last year traveling the country to track down and view as many bird species as possible. Now that 2017 is over, she joins us for a review. But first, the Southwest Florida Symphony in Fort Myers serves as Lee County's professional orchestra and is one of the oldest symphony orchestras on Florida's Gulf Coast. The ensemble's musicians have been providing a broad range of classical performances to local audiences for more than half a century, and the group is wasting no time kicking off the new year with the latest installment of their Masterworks concert series this Friday, January 6th, at the Barbara B. Mann Performing Arts Hall. The orchestra also performs a pop series, which later this month will include symphony members performing John Williams' score of the iconic film adaptation of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone as audiences relive the film on a giant high-definition screen. In addition, the orchestra provides a small stage symphony series, along with performances by the group's youth orchestra. Joining me now in studio for a closer look at what's ahead for the rest of the season, this is the symphony's executive director, Amy Ginsberg. Great to speak with you again, Amy.
Great. Thanks for having us.
And we're also joined in studio by the group's music director and conductor, Nir Caporetti. He stood at the helm of the Southwest Florida Symphony since 2015 and has been the conductor for the Santa Barbara Symphony in California since 2006. Caporetti made his conducting debut in 1993 with the Israel Symphony Orchestra and has conducted orchestras and operatic performances all over the world, including with the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra, the Vienna Chamber Orchestra, the Orquesta Sinfonia de Madrid, and that's just to name a few. And when I say a few, I mean just a few. There's a lot more. So thanks so much for being with us, Maestro.
Thank you for having us. Lovely being here.
And I invite listeners to connect with our guests and join the conversation. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And before we get into what's in store for the rest of the season here in Fort Myers, Maestro Caporetti, I wanted to hear a bit more about you. As I mentioned, you made your conducting debut in Israel, where you're from, after earning a degree from the prestigious University of Music and Performing Arts in Vienna. Tell us about your early experiences in music and maybe when you first sort of realized that music was going to be your life.
Right. I grew up in a house where there were a lot of music instruments. My father is sort of a semi-professional musician, and he loved playing different ones. So I always saw him playing and his friends and saw instruments at home. And when I was like 5 years old, I said, I would like to try some of them. So my first teacher was my father. We did the recorder, and then I wanted to do keyboards. And so I started to play the piano, and that's sort of how it started at a very early age. I always like to say that the first language I could actually could read was music much before I could read any other letters. But then growing up, I also played violin, trombone. I also sang for a while. And as I went to concerts, just, you know, to see what's going on, I immediately sort of was staring at the conductor, and I was maybe that age. I was maybe 14 years old, 15 years old, and I thought, that's what I would like to do. I didn't quite understand what the conductor does, but I was attracted to the magic. It's like a magician put his hands out and something happens. And so I followed that path, and I'm very fortunate to have made it. My passion became my profession, and as you said, it's now the fifth country I'm living in.
Right.
And that's really brought me to many places, many cultures, worked with wonderful people, learned beautiful communities, and I'm very lucky to be also part of this community.
Yeah, for the last few years, it seems you've been splitting your time between Santa Barbara, California, and here in Southwest Florida. What on earth made you want to take on, you know, leading this symphony when you're already in charge of one, literally on the other side of the continental U.S.?
Well, and that's also part of my activity, because music director is of course a role, but every conductor also guest conduct. That means that we work with other groups as just guests. And I've just made now a 1 month opera production in Italy. I continue to Chicago in Canada, where I was a guest, and now I'm here with my role as a music director. So yeah, our world is like that. We need to work with different groups. I probably work with about 100 different orchestras in different countries. And that makes our, I think, knowledge and our experience much more substantial. And it's important and enriching for every conductor to work with different orchestra and to feel what other groups are sort of reacting to. And I think I can bring this experience then to Southwest Florida. When I saw first time that it was announced that they look for music director, I made some research. I think there's a huge potential for this place. We have wonderful musicians, a very supportive community. And who would reject being in this beautiful place? I can't think of anyone. So I'm very happy to be here. And as I said, it's every conductor is if you do everything, it's not a full year commitment. So mm-hmm. we do other things as well.
Absolutely. Well, I think that segues into my next question. You're talking about the importance of working with other musicians and working with other groups. You yourself conduct in different genres as well. More classical style symphonies, but then also operas.
Correct.
And I was wondering if that's common, because I was under the impression conductors maybe, for lack of a better word, sort of get typecast into one or the other.
You're right. It is a little bit now we are put into categories. Somebody is like good for this rap or this rap. And I'm a little bit old fashioned in that sense. I made my beginning. That is the European way into getting into the podium, is to start with an opera house. First, you play the piano, and since I could play the piano, I accompanied singers in an opera house. And then if you're lucky and the conductor is sick, you get to take over. And if you don't mess up, you will be promoted. And that's pretty much what I did. And then I made my way to the podiums through the opera stuff. And that, as I said, that's the classical European way. In America, it's a little bit different. Mainly symphony conductors, not really doing so much opera, not so much ballet. I like to do everything. And also, now that I'm here, also I'm extremely happy to do pop stuff.
Right.
And, I realize what a rich world is that. And I think that's the future of our profession. If you look at the audience, we need to provide a wider repertoire, and this kind of make just a very slice of the rap is something that we cannot afford. And I have to say that on my personal level, I'm extremely happy to be able to do an opera for a month and then completely different thing. And I may do a ballet and then a pop show and then back to classic and then romantic and modern. So it keeps me really, it's very flexible and it's never a routine in that sense.
Yeah, I imagine there would be more fluidity. And, I'm thinking about, your education in Vienna and how, even in the German language, the word for someone who conducts an opera versus someone who conducts a symphony, they're two different words.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. There is German is probably the only language that makes the distinguished word between Kapellmeister, which is the opera conductor, and Dirigent, which is a real symphony conductor.
Right. just in terms of, I've heard you talk about this in other interviews before too, but in terms of how organizations like this are funded in Europe versus the U.S., there's some differences there. And does that impact maybe how you put together a what you're going to put into a series of performances?
That's absolutely right. First of all, the government funding, public funding versus private funding is a completely different attitude. I want to say that the orchestras in America with which I have experienced are a little bit more business oriented. Mm-hmm. Where in Europe, and I just had an incredible, a case I just came out of, we did 10 runs of an opera production. And to see how money is spent, and there is really always the security. Yes, the government will step in if we have a problem. So ticket sales and the programming is less important to the budget, which here it would not be the case. We need to meet the budget. We need to make sure that we sell our shows, etc. So there is a different approach. Of course, artistically, we try to thrive for the best possible. But there is absolutely a different attitude when you know that I need to talk to the Ministry of Culture and the mayor of the city and the whatever functional person that would send a check versus to know that people that actually come to see us, they are our biggest supporter. Because just imagine, you know, when you work in Europe and the biggest fund for your operation comes from somebody that probably never have heard you or never attended your concert. It's completely different take. Right.
And Amy, you know, I know from conversations we've had in the past, both on and off the microphone, you're a huge music lover yourself. That's, of course, why you're here. But a lot of the work you do is really what, you know, kind of keeps things moving.
Yeah, it's what happens in the office is very behind the scenes, but it is it's also very collaborative. I'm very fortunate to have a great relationship with Nir. I learn a lot about new music, new symphonic music from him, and how he figures out how to marry the warhorses with the lesser known pieces or the more contemporary work. And he has his finger on the pulse of the business aspect as well. So he is a phenomenal partner in the success of this institution.
All right. We're joined by Southwest Florida Symphony Executive Director Amy Ginsberg and Maestro Nir Cabretti as we highlight the orchestra's upcoming performances for the remainder of the current season. Again, listeners can join the conversation. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Well, let's go ahead and talk about the rest of the season. We've got a show just coming up this Friday, the latest in the Masterworks series called Pianorama, and that includes actually Florida Gulf Coast University's own music professor, Michael Barron. What can audiences expect from Friday's concert?
Actually, we're on Saturday.
It's Saturday.
Yeah, Saturday is the 6th.
Oh, gosh.
And, no, that's okay. That's okay. At Barbara B. Mann. And honestly, we can expect a broad demographic at this audience, at this performance. We've, in addition to our diehard classical music fans, we're seeing a significant growth in a younger demographic. Especially because there's a new relationship between popular music and classical music. So we're seeing college students and people in their 20s and 30s who are growing interest in classical performance. Nir actually can talk a little more about.
Yeah, I realize all over the world people are enchanted when they see the piano playing. And I said, how about creating a program that would just feature the piano, but not just the normal piano concerto, which would be sort of a competition between one soloist and the entire orchestra. We feature the piano in different aspects. So we start where in a beautiful piece by De Falla called Gardens of Spain. That's the piano is actually part of the orchestra. It has an important solo part, but it's really rarely dominating. It's rather collaborating with the orchestra. And we will give this role to our wonderful orchestra pianist, Ding Zhang. And then we do something that also very rarely done, which is a double concerto. So you have two pianos sort of corresponding with each other and with the orchestra. That's a Mozart. And it's sort of a genre that sort of lost his track after the classical period. And we will end up with one of the major piano concerto, the Tchaikovsky. Everybody would know that when they come in, they will hear the first notes by the horns and they will immediately be, oh, that's something we know. So I think my vision was to show the audience that piano could be so much more than just the piano concerto. And because we don't really see the piano as an orchestral instrument.
Right.
It's a word on its own. And so when it comes to the concert hall, the symphony is normally in a concerto, but we feature that in a much wider room. And we have four wonderful pianists. I want to say also local forces who are also nationally recognized. And I think that's also adds to the importance of or our mission is also to help the local forces and to make sure they get to be heard in their own community.
We're so lucky. It's for a relatively small community by comparison to the rest of the country. We have an abundance of musical talent here. And the fact that they're willing to come back home to perform with us is a real treat. We're so fortunate to have that.
All right. And Maestro Cabretti, I should also note that ahead of this Saturday's performance, you'll be conducting a pre-concert lecture.
Right.
Is this something you do before all the symphony's masterwork concerts?
Only here, actually. Oh. You know, that's one of the differences. What's the difference between guest conductor and music director? As a guest, I don't talk much. I'm not invited to many things. But that's part of the package that we give. We want to give some thoughts about the program, about the soloists, about why this piece is chosen for this particular one, what is the importance of this piece, etc., to the audience. And it's sort of a warming up to the concert. And I've seen this audience for the pre-concert lecture grows out. It's really a wonderful way for me to communicate with them, to tell them why I chose this particular. I almost every time also introduce a soloist or a musician from the orchestra. So they have a personal touch. They can ask questions, what kind of instrument they play, how, you know, very common is like, where do you come from? How long have you played? It's things like that. People want to know a little bit more behind what's going on. And that's a wonderful opportunity that we have, and we offer that for free every concert, every masterwork.
And from an educational perspective, for people who are not terribly familiar with classical music, it makes the pieces so much more accessible. Mm-hmm. It is a much deeper understanding of what you're hearing, the context it had in a period of history when it was written. And what you're hearing on the radio with the maestro now is largely what you'll get at a pre-concert lecture. It's very approachable.
Oh, right, yeah, very informal. Mm-hmm. Like, as you said, accessible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then on January 10th, we've got the next performance in the small stage concert series called For the Love of Beethoven. And the first venue is going to be Big Arts on Sanibel. But I notice that travels around to quite a few different venues here. Can you just maybe tell us about the concept of the small concert, the small stage series?
It's exactly that. Small stage symphonies were designed because it's really not fair to expect the entire community to always come to you at a giant concert hall. It's a more intimate experience. With an opportunity to hear, because not everything is written for a 60 to 80 piece orchestra. There's a lot of repertoire out there for smaller ensembles, so it gives us the ability to broaden what we play.
So these are going to be chamber pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. It's pretty much a chamber orchestra. And exactly, I mean, we want to go on the road and bring the music to places that they might not come. And Shellpoint is a great example.
Yes.
We are pretty much packed every time we go there, and most of the residents may not go anywhere else. So we're very lucky to have there a center, a performing arts center, that could, you know, provide us a good stage and a large room for a few hundred people to come. And so, yes, the pieces are smaller and more intimate. And quite frankly, some of the pieces I wouldn't like to play the Barbara B. Men that are written for this, because it would lose the intimacy of that. And that's also, as I said, it's a beautiful way for us to you know, broaden the repertoire and also to bring it to the people. And of course, playing in Sanibel, it's always a treat for anyone. And
right,
if you want to have a lovely evening with a dinner before, we also serve champagne in the break. So it makes it a nice experience all over.
And you know, going back to, you know, what the composers of these chamber pieces, whether it's Beethoven or you know, another performance later on in this series, is that what they had intended? Were these chamber pieces not supposed to be on these big venue stages?
A lot of time, not necessarily in this particular Beethoven case, but a lot of the time, yes, a composer wrote pieces, and when we say chamber, it really meant to be done in smaller rooms or smaller venues. It's a salon of an aristocratic family, whatever. And the fact that we took that away, and over the last years, you know, perform it in big places and actually extended the orchestra much more than the composer actually thought of, is a deviation from maybe the origin. But you're right. Yes, if there are some composers that wrote pieces for huge places or bigger orchestras, and at the same time, they also wrote pieces that are better for smaller groups. And that was the original idea. So definitely a few pieces in this. And also that gives us a chance to do some experiments. We just had a beautiful concert with a pianist that made his own arrangement of Picture at Exhibition, which is really a large piece. But he made a small version for chamber orchestra with a jazz combo. So, that gives us also the opportunity to try out things. And I think if people, and I said I want to make sure that people who want to attend the concert don't need to feel afraid, oh, we are not educated, we didn't go to music school, we were not listening to classical music, our parents did not take us to the New York Philharmonic with Leonard Bernstein concerts when we were young. You don't really need that. I mean, it's a plus if you know more, but just be open, and I think everybody can enjoy. Certainly, a concert that's coming up, like with the piano now, I know a lot of people who are not music educated, they come, they love it.
Wow, excellent. Well, segueing back again to that larger stage, January 20th, we have the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone concert. Explain this concept for us, what audiences are going to experience, Amy. And then, Nadir, I'm hoping you can tell us logistically how this is going to work.
Yeah, do we ever. So our intention was to do one concert. That is essentially on January 20th in the evening, sold out. So we've added a matinee. And it is exactly, you are watching the movie with the soundtrack extracted, and the symphony will perform the soundtrack to the movie live in time with the movie.
Yeah, I want to mention that today's, you know, when we talk about Beethoven and Schubert and Tchaikovsky, all these great composers, today the composers of our time are really actually film composers. So if you think about John Williams, who is probably the most celebrated film composers of today, you know, all their soundtracks are then played in symphony halls. They do suites from this and that, Star Wars I just mentioned. And then they are recorded with the best orchestras in the world. So it's kind of a trend now. How about instead of hearing the music, you know, from a box, hear it live the way the composer actually wanted it to be? And it, logistically, it's a quite complicated thing. The conductors most of the time has a click so they can be synchronized 100% with the movie, unlike in the concert, normal concert, where, you know, we have a little bit of liberty to take things a bit faster, a bit slower. Mm-hmm. Depends how we feel, how we think the music is. In a film, it has to be very precise because there are cues on certain actions. So it makes it, of course, for the conductor a little bit more complicated, but that's something that we learn. And the experience, I think, is even bigger. To see this huge film and then hear the live music coming out is absolutely breathtaking.
I had the experience of I was able to see La La Land in Nashville during the summer, and I'd never experienced anything like it. And it adds so much to the film. Hmm. It's just a remarkable experience.
Wonderful, wonderful. And of course, you know, with the success of Harry Potter, I mean, what a great way to bring in younger audiences and introduce them to classical music.
Exactly. That's also part of the idea. If you come to see that, you may come maybe, and you feel you will feel comfortable. You feel at home when you see a symphony orchestra on stage next time you come.
Mm-hmm. And on the subject of youth, of course, there's the youth orchestra. I was hoping you could tell me a bit about that, because I noticed they have their own music directors and conductors. But is there much interaction between the professional symphony members and the youth as well?
Definitely. First of all, we are very proud to have a youth orchestra. It's not something that every orchestra has. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful way for us to do something for the community. And of course, you know, it's while it has its own identity and its own conductor, I won't say conductors because we have more than right. one for the different ages, for the different groups, they're all functioning under the same umbrella of the symphony. And of course, our wonderful musicians are also coaching the young kids. So that means they bring the tradition of years of playing with a symphony orchestra with different conductors. They bring this experience tradition to the new generation and train them to be, you know, what we would love them to be, very knowledgeable about this art of music. And if they would like to continue professionally, we will give them the knowledge to do that. But that's not our main thing. We want to have the kids this musical experience, which we think will help them in anything else they will do in life.
Yeah.
And it does actually help. I mean, we have seen hard proof of that. Last year at the last concert of the youth orchestra season, the graduating seniors, 100% of them were going on to university, some of them to schools like Yale. One young lady was going on to Harvard. It overall enhances a child's educational experience.
Right. So this is a youth orchestra, but I kind of am getting the impression that you know, it's not just that. This is serious. You know, these kids take this seriously.
They take it very seriously. And again, those who don't go on to careers in professional music still take – they take their traditional academic studies more seriously as a result. It is just amazing to see how it enhances the growth of a student.
Yeah. Or maybe they end up like – you and me working for symphonies or talking to
exactly.
musicians. Well, unfortunately, we are about out of time for this portion of the program, but I would love to bring you guys back maybe later in the season and we can highlight what folks can expect because we've got – this goes through May. You guys are going to be busy for the next several months.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. We are.
Well, thank you so much to my guest, Maestro Nir Cabretti. The conductor and music director of the Southwest Florida Symphony, and executive director Amy Ginsberg. Great to have you both in studio today.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Coming up, Julie Glenn will step into the studio for a conversation with Naples' own big year birder, who crossed the country several times in 2017 to see as many birds as possible. We'll find out how many next. Stay with us.